Today, Boris Johnson wants the toughest coronavirus restrictions imposed on parts of the north of England. We look at why and the response it has caused.
What happened at the start of last week was the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, called all 10 regional mayors in England. And I think the idea was to kind of reset its dialogue with them. And he basically told them he's going to keep them informed all the way through the next couple of weeks and as you move through the winter, because the idea of the new tier system is that it gets local buy-in. So the regional mayors came off this call feeling pretty confident and happy that they'd been proactively reached out to. But then 2 days later, it kind of all imploded. There was, on the front of a national newspaper, the headline that restaurants and bars across the north would shut within days. They were furious that they hadn't been told. They felt betrayed in a way, and it really undermined any trust that had built up and set relations not just back to square one, but worse than they've ever been.
This week has seen COVID-19 restrictions ramped up across the UK. A sharp rise in cases in Northern Ireland led the nation back into a full lockdown. Pubs stayed shut across large parts of Scotland, and there were new travel bans imposed in Wales. In England, Boris Johnson replaced his localised whack-a-mole strategy with a national plan that divides the country into three tiers. Large parts of the Midlands and, from tonight, London have been moved up into tier two, preventing households from mixing indoors. But the toughest restrictions and the greatest controversies have centred on parts of the north of England. The Liverpool region has accepted that it needs so-called tier three measures, with pubs, gyms and cinemas closed. But Greater Manchester has been resisting them fiercely. There, and across other parts of the north of England, there is fury about a lack of warning, poor communication, and inadequate financial support.
They are asking us to gamble our residents' jobs, homes, and businesses, and a large chunk of our economy on a strategy that their own experts tell them might not work. We would never sign up for that.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how did COVID-19 spread so rapidly across the north of England, and what can be done to contain it? Josh Halliday, as a North of England correspondent, you've been writing a lot about COVID-19. And if we think back to the start of this crisis in Britain, it was London that was badly hit and there were rumours about a lockdown across the capital. But instead, they decided we were all in this together and we got the national lockdown. What was the response to that across parts of the north where rates were not as high?
Well, there very much was a feeling at the start that this was a London problem in the UK. But then, you know, it started to trickle across the country. And very quickly, the picture changed. And there was a feeling that there would have to be some kind of national action. So there was very quickly, I think, a feeling in the north that there had to be some really strict change to our way of life, and it couldn't just be confined to London, because we're a small country, we're a very interconnected country, and so the only thing that would work, I think it felt, was a big national lockdown.
And people supported that.
They did. People supported it because it felt like it was necessary.
And of course, we all went into the lockdown. We spent months in it. Tell me about what the situation looked like as the lockdown was lifted.
It was a complicated picture. There were still a high level cases in large parts of the north when the rest of the country started easing out of lockdown in June, when some schools returned, and then in July when the pubs reopened. I remember speaking to leaders in the northeast, and especially Gateshead, which at one point had about 85 cases per 100,000 people, which was about 5 times higher than the national average at that time. And they were saying it really is too soon for us to lift this lockdown. And when the mantra changed to stay alert, leaders in the Northeast were saying, this feels far too early for us. You know, we are still in the grip of this first wave. Our cases haven't come down and stay alert is incredibly vague. There was this impression given from London, I think, that the worst of the disease is over and we're through the worst of it and life was beginning to turn back to normal. But if you look at the high number of cases that there still were in the Northwest and the Northeast, it's clear that it was, you know, the embers of the first wave were still burning.
And presumably that is why Greater Manchester was soon back in a local lockdown, which was communicated in a way that caused real controversy. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, suggested people were to blame for not following the rules.
Across parts of Northern England, we've seen an increase in the rates of coronavirus. And one of the reasons for that increase is that we've seen households gathering and not abiding by the social distancing rules. And
they announced it suddenly on the eve of the Islamic festival of Eid, saying families couldn't visit each other's homes, but pubs would stay open. So it felt as if one community was unfairly targeted and the rules were totally confusing. In fact, when it spread to the northeast, even a minister, Gillian Keegan, couldn't tell you what you were supposed to do.
No, I'm sorry, I can't clarify that. I mean, I know in the
And
the
nor
rest
could
of the
Prime Minister, Boris Johnson.
It's six inside, six outside, and in the northeast and other areas where extra tight measures had been brought in, you should follow the guidance of local authorities. But it's six in a home or six in hospitality, but as I understand it, not six outside. That's the situation there. But
how difficult was it for people to get their heads around the rules, and how well were they followed?
It's incredibly difficult to get your head around the rules. Even now, my job is knowing what the rules are, and it's really difficult to know what the rules are today compared to what they were last week, what they might be next week, because you've had restrictions that have changed week by week, especially in Greater Manchester, which has been in a regional lockdown since the 31st of July. Different parts of Greater Manchester have different rules. And so it's been incredibly difficult to keep track of what the rules are. Local rules as well have been overlaid with national restrictions like the rule of six and the 10 p.m. curfew. So added layers of complexity have been introduced over summer. And I think that really has damaged compliance and public trust in what's been announced.
Do we know, Josh, whether any of those lockdowns worked?
On the broad face of it, if the idea of local lockdowns was to reduce the infection rate, then they patently haven't worked in almost all cases. And according to the experts and directors of public health, that's because of a lack of public confidence and confusion over the rules. And there's also the failure of test and trace.
Yeah, and not least the mistake last week that meant 16,000 cases fell off the bottom of a spreadsheet and the results were lost. Now, the rise in cases that you are talking about hasn't happened all over the country at the same rate. Do we know what is happening in these parts of the north?
It's a really complicated picture. There's a number of things that have happened. So the first wave peaked earlier in London than it did in the north. So when the lockdown was eased in London, cases hadn't fallen enough in the north. This was compounded by August and people going on summer holidays, people being out and about and mixing more. And there was a feeling of relief that the main lockdown was over, even though local restrictions were still in place. The way they were implemented meant that they were far less strict than what people thought of as the proper lockdown. And so I think that damaged compliance. And then the return of schools and universities really saw cases take off exponentially from the start of September. What has happened in some areas like Liverpool is you've had thousands and thousands of students flooding back to university, many of them actually living in multiple occupancy housing in areas, deprived areas that are already struggling. So you've poured petrol on the flames of a fire that was already burning, and it's a really bad situation at the minute in parts of Liverpool. There's also deprivation. There's more people in the northwest and the northeast with things like long-term health issues, cycles of deprivation that have been in place for generations. There's lots of insecure, low-paid, public-facing jobs, taxi drivers, takeaway workers, people working on frontline roles in the NHS, porters, cleaners, lots of people who both couldn't afford to self-isolate if they did test positive, but also were more at risk because of the job that they do. And the type of housing that people live in as well is significant. 70% of Liverpool, for example, is terraced housing. So you have people living cheek by jowl on these streets who, you know, are in each other's houses more often than not. And so it's really difficult to squash the virus once the second wave started kicking off, and it was spreading rapidly in housing, first of all, and then towards the end of summer and September, other things started coming into the mix, like hospitality, where in Liverpool, about 35% of infection clusters have happened in hospitality. There was a case of a guy in Bolton who came back from a summer holiday in Spain, and instead of self-isolating, he decided to go on a pub crawl and quickly infected at least 20 other people. And that was a huge reason for the massive increase in cases. So it only takes one case in these settings to really set off a worrying trend.
And it has been really worrying. Cases have spiked to above 500 per 100,000 in Knowsley, in Liverpool, in Manchester, and in all those areas, and in parts of the northeast and parts of the Midlands where cases have been particularly high. There is a big political challenge for Boris Johnson, isn't there? Because they include those red wall seats that he won over by promising to tackle that sentiment that London always comes first. And on top of that, he's dealing with a lot of Labour representation, MPs, councils, and the regional mayors. You've told us about miscommunication from the start that undermined trust last week when the details of this new three-tier system were leaked to the Times. How did local leaders respond to that?
So that leak to the newspaper, it sparked about a week of really fraught, angry, tense phone calls between Northern leaders who were coming together essentially to fight for answers from government. But there was also a series of briefings from people like Jonathan Van Tam, England's Deputy Chief Medical Officer.
So on this next slide, I am showing you rates per 100,000 by local authority.
And Chris England. Whitty, his boss, to MPs in the North and the Midlands when they were told how desperate and dire the situation is if no action was taken. The problem was they still weren't told what restrictions would be in place in their areas. They were only told what the evidence showed. And for the most part, MPs and regional mayors and these local leaders already knew what the evidence showed. It was only on Monday morning when MPs, who were many of them on trains down to Westminster, were given about 5 minutes, 10 minutes notice of a phone call with Matt Hancock where he would tell them what restrictions would be in place in their areas. And again, that has led to real distrust in government, a sense of they don't know what they're doing, they're sort of making it up as they go along. There's still a lot of unanswered questions about the government strategy, about how businesses will be viable in areas where the strictest measures, those in Tier 3, aren't in place. Because according to hospitality industry, the footfall in pubs and bars and restaurants is half of what it is usually. Yet they don't qualify for any support because they haven't closed, and they haven't been forced to close. And so that's led to people like Andy Street, the Conservative mayor of the West Midlands, saying that this is a really desperate situation. We need urgent government support. To start losing the trust of people like Andy Street, who is the most influential Conservative figure outside London, it really does show you how relations have deteriorated between Westminster and the regions.
And we've obviously had more controversy since then. First, there were rumours that Greater Manchester would be pushed into Tier 3 along with Liverpool. The Mayor, Andy Burnham, rejected that and said he'd challenge it legally. Then those rumours became yet more leaks in the newspapers, apparently briefed by government insiders, infuriating Burnham and others even more. Then they spent much of yesterday in heated discussions with ministers, calling for more financial support before tougher restrictions could be accepted. And ultimately, you can see why all of this looks bad for the government, because we do now have a situation that contrasts sharply from March. When it's cities in the north that are in trouble, we're not all in it together. The furlough scheme isn't as good, and we have this graded system that means while London goes into Tier 2 tonight, businesses won't be shut. Is resentment starting to build?
There is absolutely resentment and anger and frustration, and I think even disbelief that we are where we are now. I think the public in the north of England would accept tougher restrictions because we've had weeks now of really dire warnings. We've all seen the graphs of doom that are shown by Chris Whitty and England's chief medical officers that show cases doubling in these areas. Hospitals are at capacity almost in Liverpool. There is a feeling that the situation now is as bad, if not worse, than it was when the national lockdown was included. So to not have the same financial package in place has led to accusations that the government's trying to do lockdown on the cheap because it's the north of England. And that is incredibly politically damaging. But as we speak today, there has been no sense that the Treasury will change its mind and increase this furlough scheme to 80%, which is what a lot of northern leaders and business groups have called for in the north. And without that, there are warnings that 28,000 jobs in Liverpool alone are vulnerable by Christmas. In the West Midlands, there's a feeling that thousands of businesses could go bust in the next few months without urgent support. That's according to a letter that Andy Street, the Conservative mayor, sent to Rishi Sunak on Tuesday.
And we know that Burnham issued similar warnings for Manchester, saying tens of thousands of jobs could go. And said the city would be levelled down as a result, which would be the opposite of what Boris Johnson has promised for the north. He says he wants to level up. Many want short, sharp national action instead. What is the science behind any of these options?
The scientific community have been split about what the best course of action would be. But I think what we learned this week is that SAGE, the government scientific advisory group for emergencies, recommended 3 weeks ago now that the government needed to move to a position of a circuit breaker, which is a short national lockdown for 2 or 3 weeks, either in which schools and hospitality and shops would be closed, which would be a full lockdown. It should take us back to the lockdown that we had originally at the end of March and in April. Or there's a circuit breaker in which schools are allowed to stay open. And Labour have suggested that the circuit breaker, the national lockdown, could take place over the October half terms when schools would be closed anyway. But what the scientists say is that any action needs to happen urgently. And the longer you delay it, the longer the lockdown would have to be in future.
It's been suggested a 2-week circuit breaker could save 8,000 lives. But as we understand it, the government has key figures, including the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, who are rejecting that idea. Do we know why?
The reason the government haven't gone for this circuit breaker is because they're really worried about damaging the economy even further than it already is. And with some justification, it's an incredibly difficult moment for the government because the economy is already on its knees. GDP is 10% lower than it was in February. and another national lockdown, however temporary, would again do serious harm to the economic recovery. But what they've got to choose between is essentially protecting public health and protecting the economy. It's difficult to quantify what the effects would be on the economy if there wasn't a circuit breaker and infections and therefore deaths were allowed to continue to rise. Because in the third of England now, where restrictions are in place, the economy is being damaged. People aren't going to pubs, bars and restaurants as much. Footfall in the city centre remains far lower than what it was pre-lockdown. People are being told not to travel to offices. And so the damage to the economy is already happening. But what you don't have in place is the financial support that was in place in the first lockdown. So that's the real sticking point. I think most people, especially in the north of England, would welcome a national lockdown of 2 or 3 weeks if that same financial support was in place. But there's no sign that will happen unless there's a real shift in direction from Boris Johnson's government.
But isn't the bigger question here that really to get out of this, we need different tools? We had a months-long lockdown, and as we've seen, it didn't solve the problem. So it's hard to feel that a circuit breaker would do that. Wasn't the whole point of the lockdown to buy time to allow ourselves to put in place a track and trace programme that could help prevent outbreaks? What has gone wrong with that?
Well, test and trace has really struggled for a number of reasons. The first is that there was no app. That was really long delayed. Test and trace started in May. The app only came out last month in September. There have been numerous other problems with it as well. In many of the worst affected areas, the northeast and the northwest and parts of West Yorkshire, the contact tracing team have only managed to contact half of potentially infected people. So tens of thousands of people who should have been contacted and told to self-isolate have been left to roam and potentially spread the disease further. There's other problems with it as well, including that we don't check up on people to check that they are self-isolating when they're told to. And at the minute, when someone's asked to self-isolate, all you have to do is say you agree. And there's no follow-up checks. There's no telephone call. There's no door-to-door checking. And so what behavioural scientists say is that this leads to people feeling that, why should I take it seriously if the government's not taking it that seriously? The other point about test and trace is that there was no financial support until 2-3 weeks ago for people to self-isolate when they were told to do so. So you have many people in lower paid jobs, public facing roles in parts of Rochdale, Oldham, Bolton, Liverpool, who weren't able to get any financial support to help them to self-isolate and keep the disease under control. And that has led to compliance being damaged.
Coming up, what are the long-term consequences for those parts of the north of England hit hardest by COVID-19? Josh, can I ask about the long-term consequences of all of this? People have been talking about and thinking about for years how we might be able to reduce the north-south divide in this country. I mean, Boris Johnson's own rhetoric is all around the idea of levelling up. But presumably, the economic impact of this could be pretty dire and could exacerbate some of those divides.
Absolutely. It is a dire situation. In Liverpool, council officials were telling me earlier this week that 2 years of employment growth in the city is going to be wiped out in the next few weeks unless there is an increase in financial support. There's more people asking for emergency loans. There's more people at food banks. All of this, obviously, is a really bad look for a government that has won support on the back of many seats in the north of England. And it's obviously too early to say what the long-term consequences of all this will be. You know, there's already been a significant and, in fact, unknowable effect on all of our lives, even if we're lucky enough not to have lost a loved one or lost our jobs. In that sense, you're unlikely to feature on any of the official statistics, but the mental and physical toll of the pandemic is absolutely enormous and will have an impact for a long time to come. And what really keeps people up at night, the leaders in the north of England, is that their already fragile economies have been, you know, battered and potentially will be battered beyond repair over the next 4 months. And there needs to be urgent financial support, business grants, the original furlough scheme, in order to stop a really desperate situation from becoming much worse.
Josh Halliday, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Josh Halliday. Do go to theguardian.com to read his reporting on all of this. You can also follow our Westminster team and our Politics Live blog run by Andy Sparrow. And you can also find out what's going on in other parts of the country, including in Northern Ireland, where additional restrictions have now been put in place. That's it for today. My thanks to Josh Halliday. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.